This episode of Awards Chatter is brought to you by Universal Television, presenting Girls 5 Eva. Girls 5 Eva follows a one-hit wonder 90s girl group who attempts a comeback while hilariously navigating family and relationships, plus the joys and pains of middle age. The show stars Sarah Bareilles, Renee Elise Goldsberry, Paul Appel, and Busy Phillips. Don't miss the series critics call the funniest show on television. Girls 5 Eva is now streaming on Netflix and is for your Emmy consideration for Outstanding Comedy Series and all other eligible categories.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hi, everyone, and thank you for joining us for the 534th episode of the Hollywood Reporter's Awards Chatter podcast. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg. And for those of you tuning in, this episode is coming to you from Chapman University in Orange, California, where I'm a trustee professor at the Dodge College of Film and Media Arts, and where an audience of film students are with me to welcome our special guest. She is a Japanese actress who is stunning in every regard, and thanks to an all-time great performance on a hit show, is now poised to join Hollywood's A-list. You may have seen her in the 2021 blockbuster film F9, or on the 2022 Apple drama series Pachinko. But if you're at all tapped into pop culture, you've almost certainly seen her on the 2024 smash hit FX limited series Shogun, on which she plays Lady Mariko, a young woman from a disgraced family who is called upon to serve as a translator between her Japanese lord and an Englishman who shows up on their shores. For her performance, she has received off-the-charts reviews, found a tremendous fan base, and is now a top-tier Emmy contender. Would you please join me in welcoming to Awards Chatter and to Chapman University, Anna Sawai. Welcome, 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 and thank you so much for coming up to Chapman. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Of course.
I love this. It's so cozy.
Well, it's just us and a few hundred thousand listeners on the podcast.
No pressure. That's that.
Well, first of all, before we do the usual thing of going through the whole life and career story, what is today like for you after all of the buildup and work and promotion? Last night, we finally saw the final episode of what is at least the season finale, maybe the series, we'll see, of Shogun. So where were you last night, and what has it been like for you since?
I was in my hotel room watching all by myself for the sixth time. I don't know. But it was just very emotional for me because obviously it was the last episode going into everyone's hands, and it's a project that I think everyone worked so hard in. Like, it was the most tough that I've ever experienced in terms of like shooting and dedication. So it was like just saying bye to your kid, sending them off to college almost. Yeah.
Well, let's now go back to the very beginning. Can you share with us, and I know this is a more complex question for you than most, where were you born and raised, and then what did your folks do for a living?
What did my folks do? Okay. My dad was working for an electronics company that kind of traveled him and our family. I was born in New Zealand, stayed there for about 2 years, and then moved to Hong Kong. Oh, no, sorry. Before that, I was just
Don't get too excited.
I was making eye contact, and she seemed so excited that I got excited and I forgot where I grew up. I then moved to Japan for maybe like a year or two, right. Hong Kong for a year or two. And then we went to the Philippines for 5, and then moved back to Japan when I was 10.
So you've been around. And now the performing, you know, for some people, it's like elementary school or junior high school. You beat all of that, I think, from what I understand. By the age of like three, you were getting into this stuff. Can you just share how this got started, whether it's some form of performing, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So I think I was about, was I three? Was I three or was I five?
That's what I've heard.
Well, I don't know. When I was quite young,
yes.
three, two, five, I started ballet because my sister was doing ballet. Yeah. And people would look at her and they'd be like, oh my gosh, like you were born to become a ballerina. And then they'd turn to me and they'd just be like, you're so cute. Like they had nothing else to say. I was clearly not born to become a ballerina. And so when we moved to Japan, my mom tried to look for things that I could do. And I wanted to be Britney Spears. I wanted to become a singer.
Yes.
I wanted to pop out from the stage and jump.
Yes.
And like surprise everyone. And so she was looking up some classes and she found an audition for the musical Annie in Japan. So I auditioned and I saw the lady just tick my name off because I had no idea what I was doing. And I was like, that lady, I am going to get her next
yeah.
year. And so I practiced every single day. I'm not even kidding. Like I come home from school, my friends would try knocking on the door to like invite me to play at the park, and I would be practicing. She could hear me singing with the piano, and so she would just have to leave. And it worked out. Like the next year, I became Annie.
Now, this was I've heard differing things. Was it a theatrical production, or did it end up on TV? Like, how was this?
It was theatrical. It was a musical.
Okay.
So every year they audition about maybe 9,000 young girls, and two are chosen to play a double cast. Yeah.
So from that, it wasn't like it was, you know, here sometimes somebody's picked out of the blue, they're a child star, and then that's nonstop the rest of their life. You kind of went back to normal life for a little bit, right?
For a long time.
A long time.
Yeah.
How did it reemerge that you would be performing in front of others?
So after Annie, I still wanted to be a pop star. So I was doing some musicals, some auditions, and I eventually ended up joining this big music agency in Japan.
This is AVEX?
Yes, yes.
Okay, now, so they're, when you say big, they are big.
They are like the top.
Right.
Three, two, one. I don't know.
And what are they? They serve as a manager, kind of develop your talent, all of that stuff?
It's all of it. It's very different from how it works here in the States. So they kind of manage everything. They give you the lessons. They invest everything, but they also own you and you have no private life. I'm just kidding. That is a little bit dramatic, but you basically are their... I don't want to use the word product, but you know, they control
everything.
They
have a stake in you.
Yes.
Yes.
So, I was very lucky cause I got all these lessons and we were doing lessons 7 days a week from, learning how to walk like a model, doing tap dance, vocal classes, dancing class, like three or four different dancing classes, acting lessons. And so we were doing everything. And after the training, multiple years of training, you kind of are either lucky and join a group or debut as a solo singer or you're gone.
So your dream was to be the Britney Spears type pop singer.
Yes.
But you were also developing some degree of, at that point, even acting was part of the picture as just to have a repertoire of skills. Because I see that 3 years after you joined them, you're in a movie for the first time.
Yeah.
So how did that happen?
So I had already kind of found interest in acting through the acting classes. But then they were looking for a Japanese girl who could speak English and who could act. And there weren't many. And that's why I was very lucky. I went into the audition and she was like, oh, you're so young, but maybe you might be good. And then next week, they flew me to Berlin to meet the director, James McTeague, who directed Ninja Assassin, which I eventually was chosen for.
Yes.
And so we shot that in Berlin for maybe about a month. And I was like, this is the best thing ever. Like, you can become a whole different person. You can tell this amazing story. You can work with people who love what they're doing, and you get free snacks. I want to do this for the rest of my life.
So that you've gotten a taste of the acting, but now your investors at AVEX want it, where you're on the music trajectory too. So you, how does it work? They have a major record label of their own, and before any, I mean, early stages, correct me if any of this is wrong, but I did some YouTubing, and I see that the first game of the 2012 Major League Baseball season took place at the Tokyo Dome with the national anthem performed by Anna Sawai.
How did you find this?
So there was that. That was one. You could see how somebody's being kind of the same way in this country, where you're growing the profile of an artist. Another thing, I believe there was an initial earlier girl group that you would have been a part of that was not very long lasting, but is it ARA?
Yes, that was so brief, though. I'm surprised that you even have that info. I forgot about that group. It was kind of like the girls at AVEX being like, oh, we should try something until we find something official. Right. And so I don't think there's any music or any pictures out there. It's just some info, right?
Well, as far as I know, so that was 2012 to 2013, at which point along comes something which I'd like you to, you know, just share. How is this AVEX sort of doing what I think happened with like NSYNC or Backstreet Boys, or I don't know, I believe they kind of just put people together. And in your case, you were part of a group of young women who were put together in a band called Fakey?
Yes. There was an audition. They don't like to talk about it.
Okay.
But yes, there was an audition within the company, and they brought a lot of girls who had an international background or who wanted to be part of a group that was a little less catered towards the men, because I think a lot of Japanese girl groups are like, you know, innocent vibes, school uniform, and we were trying to do something that seemed a little more cool and highlighted the, you know, what is it? Like the characters,
yeah,
the
sure.
girls' characters. And so we all auditioned, and I was chosen as one of the five members of the group.
And it was called Fake EY.
I didn't have a lot of say in the name. It was a big company, and they were like, we want something really cool and like something that leaves an impression. And they told us that it was because they didn't want to go with something that was like cliche, that was like, we're the cool girls, you know? We wanted to kind of state ourselves as fake, but actually provide something real.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I hope you won't mind that we are going to take 60 seconds. And let's go to the film.
That has to be longer than 16 seconds, guys.
I think it's pretty cool. So you guys got pretty big.
I don't think so.
No?
Not as big as we hoped.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so 2013 to 2018 is how long you were part of this group. What happened that led you to decide to walk away?
So before joining the group, I had already talked to the people that were going to produce it, and they knew that I wanted to get into acting since Ninja Assassin happened. And they were like, yeah, you know, being famous, if you're part of a group like this and they succeed, then it'll help you get into the acting industry as well. So they were like, we'll make sure that it's balanced out. We know that you want to act. You can trust us on this. And then I join and this big audition comes up. It's an American movie. This amazing actor is going to be in it. And I was like, this is my chance. And then I go to my manager and he's like, you can't audition. They basically told me that if I'm gone for over a month, the girls are not going to have anything to do. So you can't do it. And for me, it was like, it could help the group.
Right.
You don't even know if I'm going to get the job. Like, at least let me try. But they just, you know, it felt like they were really tying me down. And because of my contract, I couldn't leave until the time that I actually left. So that was the shortest the contract was going to be anyway. So it was like leaving as soon as I could. And that was for like, you know, I was with the group for 5-6 years. Yeah.
Now, was... is the project that you were not able to do something that people might have seen?
Yeah.
You care to share?
I love the girl who's in it.
Yeah, yeah.
It was for Suicide Squad.
Wow. What? Which
right?
part? This was the part that...
It was for Katana.
Yeah,
they were looking for a Japanese girl and they were, you know, trying to tape everyone around the world. And I think that Karen Fukuhara, she did an amazing job and I respect her so much and I love her. But also, I would have loved to audition for
her. Sure, sure. Well, so instead you served out the contract and then a couple of episodes of a Japanese TV mystery series called Colors. Then you mentioned that it was really going back to Ninja Assassin, the casting director who had known you when you were like 16, who kind of came through with the, I think, the opportunity to at least go after the, what became the first big post-music acting opportunity. Can you just connect the dots?
Oh, is this Girihachi?
Yeah.
Yes.
Which, should we just say, this was on the BBC in 2019, and I think translates to Duty, Shame, and it's sort of like a crime thriller, right?
Yes, yes.
Okay, so you are the daughter of a crime boss, but this is the part that you were sort of the first sizable part after your music career where you're trying to get back on the track of acting.
Yeah, so because I had already spoken to my team that I wanted to leave, they were like, look, we'll let you audition, just please stay with us. And that was, I think, one or the only audition that I was able to audition for. And luckily, the casting director was like, she's great. Like, let's just hire her. So I got that role probably when I was still part of the group. And we started shooting as I was finishing the girl group. Mm-hmm. And then once I was done with the girl group, we were still in London shooting. And that's when I met my team now that I'm working with.
Which I imagine is not a coincidence that shortly, basically around that time, is also when you got the first part that really reached an international, worldwide audience. Can you share how you wind up in a franchise that you and probably most people in this room began watching when they were kids? That is the Fast and the Furious franchise in F9 out in 2021. As Elle, who we should just remind folks, lost her parents as a kid and becomes a martial artist, but as a way to protect herself.
Mm-hmm. So after shooting Girihachi, we were, you know, just taping every week, multiple times a week. And one morning I woke up and I had an email from my UK agents being like, there's an audition for a film called Fast and Furious. It's a sequel. Are you interested in taping? And I'm like, hell yeah, I'm interested. What do you mean? That's not even a question. So I think I taped like the day after or something. And I got a call being like, we want you to fly to London to meet the director and do a screen test. So I flew over. I was so nervous. But I felt like the part was for me. Like I knew that I could do. And it was like the chance that I had been waiting for all these years that I was part of Fakie and when I couldn't audition. And so I really put my everything into it. And It was a while until we heard back. It's like the most torturous time not hearing anything. But yeah, a couple of weeks later, I believe they called telling me that I had booked the role.
Did I read it was your birthday that you found out?
I think it was my birthday in America. It was the day after in Japan, but I still will say it's my birthday.
Seems to be pretty lucky because that was also the case with Shogun.
Yes,
it?
Like good things happen on my birthday. Right. I don't know why, guys. It's I love my birthday.
Well, now F9. Obviously, you get in this. This is franchise studio, big budget filmmaking at epitomized, and you're there. It's directed by Justin Lin. You have said that, and basically, unlike most parts, you had been probably offered up to that point, there they wanted an accent from you, even though you don't necessarily have to have one, right? Mm-hmm. This was one of the first, you said maybe the first example where they're like, that's, leave that at home?
Oh, yes. You're exactly right. They were the first ones that didn't require me to put on a Japanese accent. And I thought that that was so new. And I love that they were just allowing me to not be too Asian.
Right.
Yeah.
So with the Fast and Furious franchise, I know that they talk all the time about, family, right? This is the key word. Vin Diesel, all these guys. Is that what it, you're thrown in with guys that have been making movies together since you were a kid. Mm-hmm. Not that that's that long, but it was, was that intimidating? How did you acclimate to that?
I think I was very nervous walking onto set, obviously seeing the people that I see on screen, but they were all so lovely. I can remember walking onto set and Natalie Emmanuel, she had her arms wide open and she hugged me and she was like, I'm so excited that you're here. I'm so excited to have a female character who has, the power that she does, and you're so badass. And if you have any questions, let me know, because she knew how it was to be the new person on set. And Vin as well, like he was riding his scooter around on set and he came to me and he gave me a hug like he knew me from before. And it was just so warm.
And working on that scale, this is a long way from, some of the projects you'd started out in. Can you give people a sense of what it is like to make a movie on a budget of, I would think like maybe even 8-9 digits with these Fast and Furious films? And how does that affect the actor? Is it doing the same thing that you would do in anything? Or do you kind of have to fight to not get lost amidst all just the scale of it all?
I feel like as an actor, I was approaching it the same way. Also, I didn't have enough experience to be like, this is a huge budget. Like I was just going on set being like, okay, this is a movie set. Like, cool. But also you get lost on set. When it's that big, you don't know where you're going. You need someone to kind of help you around. But I don't know. It felt like the same to me. It didn't feel like it was a big budget. And so I would treat it, any different way. It's more about, I think, the art. So I wasn't too focused on like how big it was. It was lovely to just, have a nice coffee machine. Yeah. And like those kind of things.
It's always comes about back to the craft services, right? So that comes out in 2021. And just a year later is when many people through Apple got to see you in Pachinko, which will remind folks, this is an adaptation of a novel in which your character that you play in the show actually does not exist in the novel. This is Naomi, a businesswoman in 1980s Japan who's running up against the kind of societal limitations that were there at the time, may still live on in some ways. But just had you been familiar with the novel? And even if you had, again, this is a character that wasn't there. So just how did you kind of digest what you were being asked to do for that one?
I had read the novel and I loved it. It's such a beautifully written novel. And when I heard that they were going to have an audition, I remember like going back and like looking at the characters that Solomon has a relationship with, but I knew that it wasn't going to be her. And so I had conversations with Sue Hugh, the showrunner, and it just sounded like She really wanted to show the struggles of, you know, a Japanese woman in the 80s. And my mother was working in the 80s. So I really felt like that was the story that I wanted to tell. And yeah, it was kind of like the first time that people were really looking into the women's, like, the societal pressure and whatnot. And so I thought that it was a great opportunity to kind of join in. And also, because of the theme that it is, I was so happy that they were including the Japanese side of the story.
And it's, in hindsight, obviously, we wouldn't have necessarily known at the time that what you were going to be working on down the road. But I mean, there are some parallels with just what Mariko runs up against as a woman in, you know, whatever, early 1600s. And that, yeah, I mean, a lot changed, but there's still, you know, in Japan as well as in America and worse in many other places, but like just what the woman's experience has been in Japan, you're kind of chronicled at different stages, I think, which is of interest to you, you've said. I mean, you talked about even as a musician, a female musical artist running into some of this stuff yourself.
Yeah, I think that, you know, playing Naomi in Pachinko kind of led to Mariko, as you said. And with Mariko, you really get to understand it. With Naomi, we only see so much of her in the office. And so when I did talk to Justin Marks, who is the showrunner on Shogun, I was like, wow, this is like the role that I have been wanting to play. And it's finally shining a light on the Japanese woman as like the main character. Yeah. And so that was huge because like how many Japanese characters have you seen in Western film who have that kind of depth and story? Like I can't even, can anyone name any?
Well, and you've said even, and I'm jumping around a little bit chronologically because there's another project I want to also make sure not to gloss over. But when you were preparing to play Mariko, I mean, even in Japanese film, you go back and see, you can find at least one Kurosawa movie that had a kind of kick-ass woman, but not as many as you might hope.
No.
Yeah.
What's the name of it again?
Was it the Hidden Fortress? Yeah. So anyway, we'll come to that in a second. But what I want to bring up first is a project that I think you shot after Shogun, but that came out before.
Yes.
And this is something that many people have watched and enjoyed, Monarch Legacy of Monsters, which is starring you and Godzilla, and very different. You couldn't be much more different from Shogun. And you've said it was kind of part of the appeal was that it's like, you know, you're getting out of sort of the more repressed, I guess, aspects of Mariko and getting to be a more, I guess, like modern woman starring opposite a monster.
Yeah. It was such a tough shoot, Shogun, that I remember just, you know, my team flying out to Vancouver and we would talk like, oh, what do you want to do next? And I was like, I just want to do something fun. Yep. I just want to do something light. I want to wear normal clothes and I want to walk like a normal person. I don't want to think about speaking a different, you know, language. And so, although it is Japanese, it's still period Japanese.
Right.
So yeah, they were like, okay, we're going to get you something that's fun. And then I got in, maybe I was on a call and they were like, how about a monster show? And I was like, yes, let's do it. So it was what I really wanted to do, where it was just, you know, forgetting all the heavy stuff and doing something that felt like something that people can just watch for pure entertainment. Yeah. And then I read the script and it was like, oh, she's going through so much. She has so much baggage and like trauma. But yeah, that what originally kind of made me want to do it was that it was going to be something very, very light and entertaining.
What's it like acting opposite something that's not really there?
That's pretty hard. You know, you're staring at a yellow ball. Right. It's moving up and down on a stick.
Right.
They're showing you clips that, you know, what it's going to look like, but your face looks crazy on it. Like they had these figures of myself, Kurt, Kiersey, Ren, and we looked crazy, but it was so much fun.
Nice. So again, chronologically, this was before. So I guess Shogun's been in the can for a little while. It's a big editing job for somebody, so maybe that's part of it. But basically, just for anyone who has, for the handful of people who have not seen Shogun, we'll just say Lady Mariko, a young woman from a disgraced family who becomes, I think essentially you would say, like an aristocrat, having converted to Catholicism 14 years earlier, now called upon to translate between Japanese and Portuguese for her Japanese lord, Torunaga, and a barbarian Englishman who shows up on their shores, Blackthorn. This is a 10-part limited series, or maybe ongoing series. We'll see. We can hope. But obviously, well, I shouldn't say obviously, because in the lifespan of people in this room, this is ancient history, but this is a 1975 James Clavell book, which becomes one of the biggest TV miniseries ever in 1980 with Richard Chamberlain and a bunch of others, but could not have been done at that time in the kind of language or graphics or a kind of candor that this one was. So how did you first hear that they were going to try to do Shogun again? And were you already familiar with the prior versions of it?
I had not read the novel. I wasn't born when the series miniseries came out. So I didn't know anything about it. My manager, Jake, who was sitting right there, was the first one who told me about it. Yeah. He basically is always updating me on like these projects that are happening. And he was like, I think this is going to be great. It's this, you know, best-selling novel that's going to be made into a TV series. The showrunner is amazing. And I was like, okay, you know, let me know when they're taping.
Right.
Because I kind of felt like they were going to do the same thing over again, where it was this amazing project, but as a Japanese viewer, it didn't feel as real, or like you didn't really see yourself reflected in the characters. So I did my first tape. It was a bathing scene, and I just did it the way that I felt like they wanted to see it, and I didn't get a callback. And a few weeks later, they were like, okay, well, we do want to try reading with her again. Can we set a meeting with Justin Marks? And once I talked to the showrunner, I got a better idea of what they were looking for and why they really wanted to retell this story. And it wasn't anything about like, we want to, you know, do a samurai thing. It was more about like, we want to give more voice to the Japanese people. We want to show this authentic version of it that we haven't seen in Western media. And to me, that was everything. That was so important. And I wanted to do it because Mariko's story felt like she was like the voice of the people, the women that I know.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from, with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
People who haven't had a voice.
So the casting process, from you hearing about it from Jake through knowing that you had the part, were there other kind of hurdles or chemistry reads? I mean, we should say that your principal co-stars are first the actor who plays the Lord of Lord Torunaga, and he is a legendary Japanese actor, Hiroyuki Sanada. And then you also are going to be, again, you're the go-between between him and Cosmo Jarvis's character, Blackthorn. Who was on board? How did this all come together? I imagine when you're that central to it, they got to make sure that you and they mesh.
Right. I remember Hiro was already the producer, and we knew that he was going to play Lord Toranaga. Cosmo, I feel like it was like we're approaching him, and it wasn't a definitive cast yet. But surprisingly, I never had a chemistry read with Cosmo. Yeah, I met him for the first time on set. But maybe, I don't know, these professionals, you know, like they've worked on so many films. When they see people, maybe they can tell who's
Or they just pre-visit like Godzilla. They just put them in, let's see. Yeah.
But I really think that with Cosmo, maybe also because, you know, we're not on the same, we're not like getting along in the beginning. Maybe they were like, okay, we'll just see what happens. Right, It'll be fine. But we're also actors.
Right. That's true.
I love Cosmo. We're great friends.
So, and then you said it again, it came to a head on your birthday. You get a call or whatever.
Yes.
Did you realize at that point, I mean, you didn't necessarily know, as you said, much about Shogun at the beginning of this process, but by the time you were cast, did you get how big a deal this could be?
No.
Still no.
No. I feel like until a few weeks ago, I didn't know. No, because like, it's like you could do the best work and still people might not watch it. And still people may not, some people may see it and they might say that it's the best thing ever. Yeah. But to have a lot of people tune in, like you never really know. So I remember just, you know, getting into it, seeing the final edit and being like, okay, this is amazing, but people might not tune in because it's subtitled. But a couple of weeks earlier, I was like, okay, this is starting to feel like it's real and people are really enjoying it and celebrating it.
Okay, so we'll in a moment come to what it was like when it first dropped, I think back in February, was it? So, but in the meantime, you get the part, that's great, but you also now have a lot of stuff you have to do to get your act together before shooting. Can you just give people a rundown? I've heard you talk before about this, and it's kind of mind-blowing how much you had to do, just different skills and things that now you have a very, you can add a lot of things to your resume having made it through this, but like playing a character who is at least partly based on a person who actually existed, but then requiring, because of the time period and who she was, just a lot out of you.
Yes, I don't even know where to start. First, we put on a kimono and just learn how to like carry yourself in it. We learn how to walk because it's very specific. There's no running ever. We learn how to sit down, how to stand up, how to hold a teacup, how to open the door. Like there's multiple steps to opening a shoji door. Everything. It's really like you're just a baby and like you're learning everything for the first time.
Plus horse riding, right?
Yes. Okay. So the horse riding, there's calligraphy. Sorry, I forgot all the big stuff. I was starting with the basics. The horse riding, calligraphy.
Sword fighting?
Sword fighting. Sorry, I missed
that. I'm just saying because I can't believe, like, how much time did you have?
Not a lot.
Not a lot.
I think we started, so I got cast in June. Maybe we started in July. I flew to Vancouver in September. We still had about a month to prep. So it was 2-3 months of prepping.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Now, it was supposed to be shot in Japan, and then we had a little global pandemic. So I guess that's why it got relocated to British Columbia.
I wasn't part of the conversation when they were planning to shoot in Japan. So when I got signed on to it, I knew that I was going to go to Vancouver.
Okay.
Yeah.
And just the scale of the show is massive. Where are you? Is there like a lot in Vancouver, or where? How did this work? Where are you guys shot? Because it looks like they built all of Osaka and whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, so we had the Osaka castle with all the walls and the beautiful exterior of the castle. We also had, obviously, the interior inside a studio. There was also a beautiful, where they have the boats and like the bay area. Yeah, the harbor. Multiple locations where we would go back to shoot. And so it looked like a small village.
And this has come up before on the stage with actors who do long form TV, like like you did here. I mean, it's got to be, it's, I know that very few things are shot in sequence, but when you're doing this much, do they at least do it in blocks or something to make it somewhat manageable? Or are you having to do episode 10 and then go do episode 1?
Oh my God, that would suck.
Right?
That would be so hard.
Yeah.
Thankfully, we were doing chronologically. Okay. So I think it was like episode 1 and 2 together, 3 and 4 together,
okay,
5 and 6. So it was really, really helpful, obviously, building the character, building the chemistry with the co-stars, following the storyline, and really just polishing as we got to the end.
So I watched it as it went along, and last night I'm done, and I'm still processing how great the show is, but also how difficult your job was and what a great job you did. And the thing that I think impresses me the most is that you're playing a character who has to communicate to the audience how she is feeling, or you are having to communicate to the audience how your character is feeling, while your character is doing everything possible to withhold from anyone else in the story how she's feeling. So you have so narrow a path to how you do that. And I'm wondering, just that, was that one of the more daunting things going into this? And what were the solutions for you to communicating? I mean, it works perfectly, but I can't figure out how.
It was the most difficult thing. I really struggled, and I feel like I felt so stuck, because it feels like you're not really doing enough when you're an actor, but you're having to conceal everything that you're feeling because of the character's state. And I don't know. I don't have an answer. I feel like we just kind of got through, but I was doubting myself in those scenes. And I remember just calling people and being like, I don't know what to do. And I would go to Hero and ask for his advice. And he would just tell me that's exactly what the character is feeling, where she feels like she's just stuck. She's unable to express. And she's feeling like she wants to take her own life. And not that I was feeling that way.
No.
But he was like, just stay true to what you're feeling. Don't try to force anything, because once you start forcing it, it's not going to be true to the character. So I just believed in him. I didn't believe in myself enough, but I feel like when we got to episode 9 and the character was feeling like she was allowed to go to the Lord and express everything that she was feeling, and, you know, she was able to physically fight, and, you know, she was so liberated that I felt the same way. So in hindsight, I can tell that it was only because of the character's journey that I was doubting myself. But in the moment, it was a really tough shoot.
Well, and I guess a kind of interesting thing is that, or at least a portal into the way she's actually thinking, which, again, I can't think of too many other examples of films or TV programs where this has been the way you learn about the character. But your character, again, is the go-between, the translator between principally these two other characters. And it's what we see the subtitles of what Tornaga is saying, and we know in English-speaking audiences what Blackthorn is saying, and then we see what you choose to include or omit or frame it or whatever, which is also a window into the mindset of the character without being particularly overt. So I guess anything you want to say about that?
I really enjoyed when I read those scenes. It was so much fun because you can tell she's not saying what she's feeling, but you can tell from the way that she translates what she is feeling. And I think that is her power, where her words are, she is the only one who understands both parties, and she can use that without really taking like action. And so I love how she uses the translation. I love how she uses poetry as a way to really express when she's not really given the freedom to do.
Yeah.
So,
two or three big turning points I just want to mention, and then ask you how that affected the way you were able to play the character after these. Episode 4. She believes her husband has died. Episode 5, turns out he didn't. Sorry, guys. It's been out for a while. Slow pokes. Come on. We're not going to give everything away, but we're here to talk about this. And episode 8 in the tea house, she kind of lets loose.
Yes.
And finally, I will say, I believe at the end of episode 8 is where we for the first time see her look her lord in the eyes when he asks her if she's ready. And my understanding is you're not supposed to look the lord in the eyes, but at this point she does, and it's go time. So these moments or any others that you might want to invoke, just where do you feel the performance was able to change, you changed just as a result of what you could now, how the character had changed?
Yes. I feel like episode 4 is so special because we finally kind of see her be herself in certain moments with Blackthorne. Yeah. And you really can tell that her husband is the one that's making her kind of shut down and be kind of like steel. And so shooting 4 was very fun. And 5 was actually the hardest for me because that was when I was going through the whole thing of like, oh, she's feeling this, but she's not allowed to express it and she feels stuck. But I do believe that, you know, episode 8, when we finally see Buntaro and Mariko together, it's really beautiful because we don't really see them. They're not happy, but we don't see them really share that kind of moment prior to that scene. But obviously, he asks her to go to death with him, and he doesn't understand. Like, for her, dying is not what she wants. Like, she wants to serve her purpose. Obviously he feels like the Lord is giving up, and that's why he wants to die before they are killed or whatnot. But for her, she's never had a happy life with him. She doesn't believe that he sees her. And the eightfold fence is something that's beautiful, where it's also like three hearts. Like, you don't show your true heart. There's a heart that only you know. But in that moment, she does have to tell him, like, that's not what I want. And so it's a heartbreaking scene, but also he's a very abusive husband. Yeah. And you can tell from previous scenes that it wasn't the first time that he's laid hands on her. He treats the son in a similar way. And so I think that was something that he kind of needed to just be like, you just don't get it.
So as you've looked back, you said a few times at the series and different, as it's rolled out, maybe different cuts or whatever, have you experienced it? But now watching it back it's been a few years actually, right? So what, with the benefit of hindsight, are you proudest of? Is there a scene or an episode that you are proudest of? Of your own work?
No, I'm just kidding. I'm usually not too proud of what I do. I always feel like I could have done this or that. But I really loved the scene where, this is episode 9, she comes face to face with Ochiba. And they have this conversation. And first it looks like, they're, on opposing sides, and they don't meet eye to eye, but you can really tell that they both care for each other and they both really miss each other. And the expression that Ochiba has, Fumi, is amazing. And it was just like, I felt so much from her. And the last poem that she...
A flower is a flower.
A flower is only a flower because flowers are only flowers because they fall, is my favorite line in the show. It's just so we took that from Hosokawa Garasha's death poem. And I remember going to the writers and being like, should we actually use the poem? But they wanted to make sure that it was simple enough that people would understand exactly what she was saying. And so we went with flowers are only flowers because they fall. And I think it was the most beautiful, perfect thing ever.
That's great. So, okay. We've talked about what it was like to watch episode 10 last night. Episode 1 premiered on February 27th and was immediately... I mean, I think they said the biggest FX premiere in years, beating The Bear, which is not a little thing.
Beating,
right? It's a great show, right? A handful, I think, a Murder at the End of the World. Just a lot of big, very successful shows. This is a phenomenon. And it's only grown as people have been able to catch up with it on Hulu, where it's on demand. And I guess, you know, just week by week, the critical response, the viewership has been tremendous. What has it been like for you to kind of, you've never had this big of a platform before. Mm-hmm. So just having people see what you can do and respond to it so strongly. I mean, talk about that.
I don't know. I feel like I'm still processing it because my manager knows so well that I've had a pretty rough, bumpy ride. And there were moments where I was like, oh, I'm not good. I don't know what I'm doing. I've lost all my confidence. And then now people are like, oh my God, she's amazing. Yeah. So I think I just take it with a grain of salt where it's like, oh, thank you. I don't believe it 100%, but it's an amazing feeling to just have your work praised and being appreciated. Like, it's so nice. Thank you.
How about in the business? I don't think you're normally based in LA, are you?
I go back and forth. So between Tokyo and LA and sometimes New York.
Okay. Yeah. But I mean, so you're obviously in the LA area at the moment. Are you already, I mean, I would imagine this started a while ago, but I'm not you. So I want to ask you how the response from the business, are you finding everybody suddenly wants to work with you and things are picking up in that regard?
A little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm having meetings with people like, you know, people that have done amazing work that I am a fan of. And so, yes, I do feel a little bit of difference, but I think that it's also because like people didn't know me, right? So it doesn't feel like because I did this amazing thing, it's more like people are starting to hear my name a little more often. They're like, okay, let's try to, you know, have a meeting.
Okay. So last, three things for me, and then we'll close with some student questions, if that's okay. We're not going to say anything further about the plot details, but could the show continue, and should the show continue, beyond the episodes that have already been made?
We did cover the novel. Mm-hmm. So I think we won't be able to continue on with James Clavell's story, but it is loosely based on our history. So history is still being written, right, as we speak. And if they wanted to continue, they could obviously go into the wars that happen after that. And so, yeah, I think there is a possibility, but I'm also in no place to say it. You know, it all depends on the studio and the writers. So I would love to watch it. Wouldn't you guys?
Yeah. Okay, next. Now that I imagine there are more opportunities, interest than there's been before, is there one thing specifically, if you could work with someone, do a specific project, like if somebody came and said, Anna, tell us what you want to do, we can snap our fingers and it's happening for you as an actress, what would that be?
It's a secret.
It's a secret? Does that mean it's happening? It's in the works?
I really want to make this happen.
Okay.
Yes, I'm so passionate about this story, and I don't want anyone to steal my
idea. That's fair enough.
But I'll come back, and I'll let you know if it ever happens.
We are going to hold you to that. All right, thank you. Last thing from me, what has been the compliment about your work on Shogun that has meant the most to you so far?
Ooh. I feel like it's something along the lines of, I saw her in previous stuff, didn't really think too much about her, but in Shogun, she really shines. It means a lot.
I think that makes sense. All right, so we have some microphones that are going to go around. Here you go.
Hi, my name's Maya. First of all, thank you so much for coming. I am almost done with Shogun and you are doing such a fabulous job. I absolutely love the show. So I think we can all agree that Mariko is a very beautiful and compelling character. And I think part of that is her complexity with her past, her state of mind. And obviously her situation. So I was wondering, how did you approach such a complex character, especially given the context that she is a woman in 16th century Japan?
That's an amazing question. Thank you, Maya. Being Japanese, having to conceal your true thoughts is pretty normal, unfortunately. And it's something that I didn't really have to really think about to do, because I've seen so many people who have been through situations, not as intense, but similar kind of situations. So it was something that just naturally was able to, like, you know, bring to the audience. But I think the more complex stuff was about her being a Catholic yet a samurai, because those are very two opposing ideas. And one is, you know, you're not supposed to take your own life, whereas the other is, if the Lord says so, you're going to cut your stomach in that moment. And so I remember having conversations with Rachel Kondo, who is the co-creator and writer and producer, executive producer. And she had shared with me some beautiful stories about her grandmother, and that really helped me create Mariko and her multiple layers.
Hi, my name's Julius. So as someone portraying a character with such deep levels of emotions, how do you manage to find a way to balance your work-life balance, essentially, to separate your own emotions with the character's emotions?
I would like to know that, because it was my first time playing a character so heavy that I feel like I was also getting a little bit, not depressed, but it was hard to separate her on weekends. So I would find myself just isolating myself on the weekends in my apartment, just knitting, doing very boring stuff. And I would have nightmares about, like, similar to what Mariko was experiencing in that episode. So I still don't know. I guess yoga helped me a little, but I think that I need to actually talk to someone about that and get some advice.
Anna, hi, I'm David. Thank you so much for being here. You're absolutely captivating in Shogun and so phenomenal. Thank you so much. My question was about notes from directors specifically. I'm just curious if you'd be willing to share what type of note do you like to receive, and what might be something that as a director, maybe you wouldn't want to hear from a director, I guess. I don't know.
Yes. That's actually the first time anyone's asked me that kind of question. I love it. I think that it was always very helpful for me when the director came and kind of guided me through what Mariko was going through, and being like, okay, well, this, you know, maybe she's thinking about her son, or giving me specific things to think about. And it would have been so much harder if someone came to me and just been like, I want you to be emotional, because you know, I know that too. I'm reading the script as well. And so when you can, if a director is more specific and really can think as the character, I guess, it really helps, because sometimes the actors aren't able to do that. They have so much stuff on their mind. So just really kind of guide them through the character's thoughts, I would say.
Hi, I'm Via. I'm a screenwriter. And I'd like to ask a few questions, one question as someone who's also from the other side of the Pacific Ocean. But sometimes I experience things, I feel like it's harder for me compared to my maybe American friends. And what's your suggestion for someone who has an international background, who's trying to navigating a life in the industry?
I think that storytelling is universal. It doesn't, you know, the themes in Shogun about politics and greed and relationships and all that stuff, you don't have to be Japanese to understand that. So I don't know what kind of role that you want to play in the industry, but if it's storytelling, then find something that speaks to you, because whatever that is, I think that if you're human and if the theme is very is genuine, or is it, I don't know the right words to explain it, but if it's something that is true to you, then it will speak to other people. I know that that's such a broad way to kind of give you advice, but just also surround yourself with people that have the same value as yourself, as people who want to tell the same story. I feel that if you're working with people who are passionate about your work, then you'll be able to create something that is meaningful to other people as well.
Hi, my name is Bella, and seeing that you had a background in music and dance, I was wondering what is maybe an album you've been listening to recently and if you're still training in dance at all. Thank you.
Thank you, Bella. I'm not training in dance, but I would love to do like a musical movie one day. Maybe that's when I start. But albums. You know what? My publicist was just, I was in her car and she introduced me to Taylor Swift's new album. What is it?
Tortured Poets.
Tortured Poets. Yes. And I was listening to it on the way here, just on repeat. So that's what I've been listening to. Yeah.
On behalf of all of us, I just want to thank you so much for, at a crazy time in your life, coming up here and doing this. We really, really appreciate it. Thank you.
I enjoyed this so much.
Thanks for listening to Awards Chatter. We really appreciate it and would really appreciate you taking just a minute more to subscribe to the podcast and to leave us a rating and review on your podcast app. And to follow us on Twitter and Instagram, where our handle is @AwardsChatter. On those platforms, we announce upcoming guests and provide details about special live recordings of the podcast that you can attend. Until next time, thanks again for tuning in.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.